Hello, listeners, and welcome to Ohio Mysteries. Wow, do we have an episode for you tonight. Once in a while, you hear a story, and the hair on the back of your neck stands up. Stay tuned, because not only is this one of them, but we are calling for all of you to share this episode and try to get some answers. Now, before we get to this episode, let's get into our week in review. Last Sunday, Paula brought us the true crime episode of a 35-year-old biochemist in 1987 who moved from New York to Lima with his family, and he was found murdered in his basement. The police said they hit a dead end when his estranged wife quickly moved to Florida, and the case was causing their small department to lose too much money. On Wednesday, Ohio Mysteries Backroads with Mike and Dan brought us one man's passion about airplanes that led him to purchasing rare aircraft and assembling them in his yard. Now, let's throw another log on the fire, campers. Let's dig up a new Ohio mystery. I'm your co-host, Steve Yoder, and with us as always is our award-winning journalist who spent 30-plus years at the Akron Beacon Journal telling stories just like this one, Paula Schleiss.
Hi, everybody. We've got a special episode for you tonight, an interview with three tenacious women who are bringing a lot of attention to a sad and strange case out of Parma. It's the story of Dawn Pacella, a whistleblower who was found dead in a scene that initially suggested she drank herself to death, but on closer inspection has many believing she was murdered and the scene staged. The problem is, the suspects could be up so high on the food chain, they're all but untouchable. Her story is being told in a weekly YouTube installment called Seeking Justice, hosted and investigated by Dana, Lexi, and Andrea. So instead of our usual template of me telling you the story, we're going to let the Seeking Justice team explain the facts of the case and what they've learned. Welcome to Ohio Mysteries, ladies.
Thank Hello. You. Happy to be here.
Yeah. Why don't each of you take a turn and tell us a little bit about yourself, and somebody explain how the three of you came to be together on this project.
Awesome. So hello, everybody. I'm Andrea Cipriano. I'm proud to be one third of Seeking Justice. I'm a Manhattan-based forensic psychologist, journalist, and victim advocate. I graduated with a master's in forensic psychology from John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And I was first introduced to Dawn's case about a year ago. Dana, Lexi, and I worked at Uncovered. And for those of you who don't know, Uncovered.com is the nation's largest cold case database. So we take case submissions for the database. And last spring, a man named Tony Viola, who we will definitely talk more about in this episode, he sent us an email. And he said, there is a suspicious death out of Parma, Ohio. And I believe it's a murder case. Her name is Dawn Pacella, and she was my friend. So we got the submission, and you know, one thing that really struck out to me was that Tony said, don't just believe what I'm saying, believe all of the documents that I'm going to send you. So from there, you know, after researching Dawn's case further, I turned to Dana and Lexi and I said, I need your eyes, I need your brains on this with me, because this case is just, it's too big for one person.
And Dana.
So I'm Dana Pohl. I am a cold case researcher and an advocate. I was born and raised in Pittsburgh, where I earned a bachelor's in journalism and communications from Point Park University and a master's in library and information science from the University of Pittsburgh. I am the producer and host of True Crime PI. It's a podcast, and I'm one third of Seeking Justice. Seeking Justice was born when I started watching content creators go live on their channels. And I loved how the audience could interact through chat. They could ask questions and they could comment. I thought it would be an effective way to engage viewers in the investigation of a case, but no one was using it that way. I shared my idea with Lexi and Andrea, and here we are.
I absolutely love that element of your project, these live interviews and your live investigation. Very, very cool. Lexi, how about you?
Yeah. So I'm Lexi Kakis. I'm a New York-based cold case advocate and researcher. I went to Malloy University, where I got my BA in media communications. I am also the co-host of another podcast called The Broken System with Robert Palmer, which focuses on the complexities and flaws of the criminal justice system. And I, too, am one third of the Seeking Justice team. But for me, after I was brought in onto this case, I was really drawn into Dawn and who she was as a person. And it was very clear early on that she was someone that we would all be friends with and likely would have been an advocate right alongside of us. So it was a very natural choice to want to be a part of the Justice for Dawn team.
Well, thank you so much for sharing this incredible story. Let's go to the very beginning of this very curious case. Who exactly was Dawn Pacella?
So Dawn was born on June 28th, 1985, to her parents, Ed and Karen Pacella, and she had two sisters, but Dawn actually was the youngest. For a long time, she was homeschooled most of her life. But just before her senior year of high school, she really begged her parents to join in a traditional high school setting, and her parents eventually obliged. And then she went on to community college, so she attended the Cuyahoga County Community College, and she was super involved there. She was the president and founder of her Phi Theta Kappa, and a member of the National Honor Society's Dean List, and she was a really important participant in the Criminal Justice Club. We know that Dawn cared a lot about animals and she loved to volunteer. And even in her free time, when she was on break later in life, when like on her job, she would often be known to hand out roses to strangers just to brighten up their day because she could. But most of all, she was a really fierce advocate for justice who was profoundly curious and she was playfully rebellious.
So tell me about, let's jump up maybe to 2009, when Dawn was hired by federal and state prosecutors to serve as office manager for this multi-jurisdictional mortgage fraud task force. Somebody explain, what is that task force and why would Dawn have been interested in that job?
Yeah, so Dawn originally was started working, doing administrative work for the Attorney General. She was hired by Arvin Klar, who was actually one of Dawn's former professors while she was at Cuyahoga County Community College. But not long after her time working in the Attorney General's office, she was then transferred to work within the prosecutor's office within the task force. And to Dawn, she actually saw this job as kind of a stepping stone. She really had her sights on the FBI and had spoken with them about one day joining, but she really needed a stronger resume before she could jump into all of that.
And she was the office manager, but her goal was to actually use that as a path toward a more investigative career.
Yeah, exactly. She was really focused, like she was studying criminal justice in college. And so she really kind of wanted to do the whole FBI thing, but like her, after speaking with a lot of her professors, she kind of needed a little bit stronger of a resume before she could really make that jump.
Now, at some point, this dream job of hers turns into a nightmare. So when did the job start just going dark for her?
Yeah, so Dawn was aware of a lot of misconduct that was happening inside the office. So things from how the evidence was being handled in just boxes in the office and stacked in the hallway. She was asked to take hard drives home. There was lots of different people in and out of the office. Her signature was being falsified. I mean, there was even one of her bosses, Dan Caceres, who was one of the prosecutors, was having an affair with one of the government witnesses. So from so many different angles of all of this, there was just a lot going on. But it all goes downhill when Dawn was asked to wear a wire at one of Tony Viola's rallies in order to obtain details about confidential defense trial strategy.
All right, well, we got to get to know this Tony Viola because I know he's a really big role in this case. So who is Tony? Is it Viola or Viola?
Viola, yeah.
Well, who is Tony Viola?
So Tony Viola was wrongfully convicted of mortgage fraud. He was indicted on federal and state charges, and he had two trials. He was accused of orchestrating what they had called at the time the nation's largest mortgage fraud scheme, and where they claimed he had stolen $46 million. Tony was found guilty on the federal charges on April 1st, 2011. But during this time, Tony and his friends created the website FreeTonyViola.com, and they would hold rallies in support of his innocence to get the word out on a really community-based level. And we also, I would also suggest that anyone listening check out all of the documentation related to Tony's case and even to Dawn's case are both on freetonyviola.com and the Evidence Locker and Justice for Dawn. But Dawn essentially attended five of these Free Tony Viola events where she was told to wear a wire from her bosses at the prosecutor's office. And it became really clear to Dawn that Tony was an innocent man. And Dawn started to support him as herself, not as this undercover individual. And then the roller coaster kind of just starts from there.
Do we know why they were targeting Tony to begin with?
So that's kind of an ongoing mystery because a lot of the documentation that we have, he didn't do any of what they were claiming. And later on, we'll find out that the evidence that they had to support their claims, that also goes missing. So it's, I think they just kind of were kept working on this theory, but they didn't have proper evidence to prove it. But they were so far along in the trial at this point that they were just kind of going with the momentum of it all.
Okay. And even to add to that, Tony was one of 1,000 people involved, you know, who was indicted as part of this mortgage fraud task force unit. So he wasn't one of the only people who was facing these charges. He was one of close to 1,000, but Tony would not plead guilty. There were so many people in this task force or, you know, who were being charged by the task force who did plead guilty because they were being threatened by the prosecutors. And Tony wouldn't take those threats. And so he wanted to take everything to trial.
So Dawn on her own became convinced that Tony was innocent.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Was Dawn talking to anybody at that time, friends, family, coworkers, about what she was seeing, what she was feeling? Do we know what she was going through while she's got this conflict between what her job wants her to do and what she believes personally?
Yeah, she was talking to her parents. She was talking to her sisters. Both of her parents and one of her sisters has told us that she was very internally conflicted about this because when her bosses originally told her to go wear a wire, she was really apprehensive about it because, of course, at this time, she's about 24, 25, and she's asked to go do something that's really scary. She had no undercover training, so it was something that she was very concerned about. But she also knew that, you know, like what Lexi was saying, if she wanted to advance her career, if she wanted to get a future job with the FBI, she felt like she needed to be in the good graces of her bosses. So doing what they were asking her to do, even if it scared her to death, she was willing to do it at that time. But again, it wasn't until she starts to realize that Tony isn't the guy that they're painting him out to be, and he definitely didn't do what they're alleging. So she started to realize that something is absolutely wrong.
And we'll just remind our listeners that at this time, Dawn is an office manager. She's not an agent. She's not an investigator. They are asking her as an office manager to be wired and go do this.
Correct. Okay. Yeah. And even to add to that, Dawn never had any law enforcement training of any kind. So she's truly a private citizen who works in the prosecutor's office as an office manager. That's kind of the extent of her role.
Do we have any insight into whether she was scared of work? I mean, was she being threatened or coerced, or did she ever voice that she was, you know, felt concerned for her safety?
Yeah, she definitely did. And it starts to escalate as we go through this timeline a little bit. But, you know, one thing that Karen, Dawn's mom, has told us is that the moment Dawn came home and said to her parents, you know, they're asking me to wear a wire and they're asking me to go to these events to essentially obtain defense strategy, her mom told her to quit her job. And because she was just too afraid. And she, you know, Karen tells us a little bit in our third episode that we have in our series, you know, she says that it was so difficult to hear Dawn talk about what was going on in the office because it scared her to death knowing that her young daughter who just graduated is being forced to do all of this stuff.
Well, let's go to the day that Dawn died. Tell us what was going on that day. What was she supposed to be doing?
I feel like I need to back up a little bit so that you can get a little bit of background around that day. So by the time Tony is found guilty in his federal trial, Dawn reached her tipping point at work. This is the end of her job at the mortgage company. Not long after that, Dawn
confessed. What year was that, Dana?
That was 2011. Actually, okay. April 1st, 2011, Tony was found guilty.
So she is fired from her job after the federal trial's done, but before the state trial?
Yes. Okay. Exactly.
Continue. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So not long after that, Dawn confesses to Tony that she wore a wire and that she has evidence that will exonerate him. So she comes forward, she's feeling guilty, and she knows she has to make it right. Tony is shocked by Dawn's confession, but because he plans to represent himself in the second trial, he knows he needs Dawn's help. I mean, he needs her to win. In episode 3 of Seeking Justice, Tony shares several stories of what he calls Dawn's trial prep, when the two spent months role-playing trial scenarios, organizing documents, and preparing exhibits for Tony's trial. Then in January of 2012, Tony begins serving his 12 and a half year sentence. And in February of 2012, his second trial begins. Once the trial starts, Dawn's former bosses, Dan Caceres and Mark Bennett, see the irrefutable evidence that Tony is presenting, and they literally start to panic. When the prosecutors realize that Dawn will be called as a witness, they tell her that if she testifies, she will be arrested. Dawn leaves her apartment and stays with her parents for 3 weeks. And then she returns to her apartment just 3 days before she is to testify as the final witness in Tony's trial. But she never gets that chance. Dawn does not show up to testify, and Tony's case goes to the jury. The next morning, Tony is called to court, and Judge Gall announces that Dawn was found dead in her apartment from what appears to be an alcohol overdose.
I can't even imagine that bombshell moment. Before we go further, would you explain to me why there are two trials? I mean, I would think you'd go through the federal trial, you'd be done. Why is there a state trial?
Andrea, do you want to take that?
Sure. Yeah. So when Tony was initially indicted on both federal and state charges, you know, he's talked very publicly about this whole idea that, you know, in the U.S., there's this concept of double jeopardy. You don't get charged for the same thing twice. But it seems like, you know, that's really only on a federal or a state level. So they really doubled down with Tony and gave him the same charges for both the state and the federal case. So I think part of what makes Tony's, the instances in the state trial where he's now defending himself and he has all of this new evidence that didn't exist the first time. I think that's part of why Mark Bennett and Dan Caceres panic so much, because they would have thought this second trial is a slam dunk. It's a literal repeat of the federal trial. They're thinking this is just, you know, they're bringing in the same evidence. He's going to be found guilty. No problem. So when Tony comes out, starts representing himself and is now bringing forward evidence that only someone inside the task force would have had, which points to Dawn, they start to completely panic.
And the charges are basically the same, just one at the federal level, one at the state level. I had no idea.
They're identical.
No idea that you could.
There were 59 total. And I believe when all is said and done, he was facing well over 200 plus years in prison, which in and of itself is unfathomable. But when he was sentenced, he ended up being sentenced to 12 and a half years.
Okay. And that was the federal one. When they announce, when the case goes to the jury and they announce about Dawn, are they still waiting for the jury's decision, or did that lead to a mistrial?
No, they were still waiting for the decision, and Tony was exonerated.
He was exonerated. Now, if he's exonerated at the state level, what happened to his federal charges?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. So part of the issue, and this is something that Tony's actually still, there's ongoing litigation today about this. Because this evidence was entered at the state level, he's trying to get it so that it's entered at the federal level so that he can be fully exonerated of the federal charges as well. But there's been some judicial blocking there. So that, you know, that still stands.
So I find it interesting, even without Dawn's testimony, there was enough evidence for the state to the jury at the state level to find him not guilty.
Yes. And Tony credits Dawn for that. He absolutely credits Dawn for that. He does not believe he could have won that trial without her coaching and their, you know, months of meeting to have him be prepared enough to be exonerated. So,
and Tony wants his own representation too. I think that's really important to mention, which adds a whole extra curveball and challenge to all of this.
Was he an attorney?
No.
Wow.
Yeah.
How interesting. Okay, so we get to the day that they reveal Dawn has died. She drank herself to death. What was she supposed to have been drinking?
So the evening before Dawn died, her parents, Ed and Karen Pacella, dropped by her apartment for a short visit. The three talked over cups of coffee, and you know, Dawn expressed that she was worried about testifying, but happy that it would be over soon, and that she would be able to move on with her life. With all the stress Dawn had been under, Karen worried about her daughter's drinking, and often made it a point to discard any alcohol she found in Dawn's home. This night was no different. This is how we know that there was no alcohol in the apartment when Karen and Ed left at around 9 p.m. because Karen had searched and looked and was sure that it was either discarded or it didn't exist. As they were saying goodbye, Dawn answered a call and said, "My parents are leaving now." So she got a call from a male caller and she said, "My parents are leaving now." But she did not tell her parents who that caller was. The following day, after several calls to Dawn went unanswered, the Pacellas became worried. Her father drove to her apartment, and when she didn't answer the door, he contacted the Parma police and asked for a welfare check. When the Parma police arrived, they found Dawn dead on the floor in her dining room. Karen and Ed shared their heartbreaking memories of that night and the following day in episode 3 of Seeking Justice. And to answer your question specifically, Dawn drank vodka and only vodka. So there's a little bit of a mystery around that that I think Andrea may share as we move forward in the story.
Mm-hmm. So I think in her parents getting rid of all the alcohol in the place, I think that's hinting at Dawn having had a drinking problem. So which would make a perfect way to frame somebody. Mm-hmm. But tell me a little bit about her past with alcohol.
Yeah, so we know that the stress of the job that she was under was really starting to get to her. Both her friends and family detail that, you know, around the time when Tony was found guilty in the federal trial, so in, you know, early of 2011, the stress was becoming too much. And what, you know, Dawn used to be just a very simple social drinker, became a little bit of a way to numb, I think, some of the stress and the emotions that she was feeling. She told her family that she was feeling responsible for a lot of the stuff that was happening with Tony. And, you know, and that really got to her. So over the course of those couple months, we know that her parents have described that she lost some weight, some of the vibrancy that she had of herself and her personality kind of dimmed a little bit. So, you know, by the time we come up to the trial, there's a little bit of hope there. Those 3 weeks beforehand when she was with her parents, she wasn't drinking. Her parents say she was back to her bubbly self. And, you know, like Dana was saying, she was really looking forward to moving past this, to testifying, to close this chapter and start something new.
You know, why is it so unlikely that Dawn died the way, and I assume the officials ruled, the coroner ruled, an accident or suicide?
Yeah, they ruled it as just an alcohol overdose.
Why is it so unlikely? What evidence do we have that suggests this was a premature ruling, that it really didn't happen that way?
Yeah, so there's definitely a couple things to consider with this part here. One of the real troubles is that her death was never properly investigated. So the responding police officers and the death investigator who came to her house, they make the alcohol death conclusion without knowing some of the additional circumstances of what Dawn was up against. We believe that their initial conclusion is honestly just taking Dawn's death at face value. It's seemingly because, yes, there was some vodka found in her apartment, and her dad did share with the police that she was struggling with a drinking problem. You know, that is undeniable. But there's more to the story because, of course, there's additional evidence that the original responding officers just didn't know. So how could they consider it? They didn't know that she was about to go on trial and testify to misconduct that she witnessed. That if the responding police even interviewed her parents once, the Parma Police Department would have known that she was about to testify to what would have called into question over 1,000 convictions from the Mortgage Fraud Task Force Unit. There is a lot at stake to her being alive, which I think brings to the fact that there's a lot at stake for her to be dead. And, you know, even talking more about that, in our fourth episode, we brought on Detective John Dawes. He's a retired homicide and cold case detective, and he took a look at Dawn's case. He's seen over 100 alcohol deaths in his law enforcement career, and he noted that the apartment itself, the state of Dawn's body, all of this did not match what a textbook alcohol death should be. And, you know, he goes into a lot more detail on that in our episode. We actually presented some non-graphic photos of the state of her apartment in that episode, and Detective Dawes goes photo by photo, and he just breaks down why he thinks that this is not a simple alcohol death.
Yeah, that's a fascinating episode, watching his dissection of the crime scene there. Tell us about Dawn's family. You guys have been able to, you know, interview them, her mother at least. And they've been pretty active in this case, haven't they?
So Dawn's family have been incredibly active this entire process. Through the creation of the show, they were on board the moment that we shared this idea with them. And they've been really wonderful to get to know along throughout this entire process. This is not an easy thing to have to kind of work through with them. You know, it brings up a lot of really hard and challenging memories, but they've been so gracious to us to kind of share this part of their child with us. So it's been really nice to kind of get to know them in this way. But every time they talk about her, like, their face lights up. You know, they're just trying to heal, I think, at the end of the day. And so they just really want the answers and the closure. And even in episode 3, where we speak with the parents, Karen says, like, she just wants to be able to forgive them. But she can't do that until she has the answers that she needs.
Yeah, I think that's one of the hardest parts of any true crime story I've ever done, is just seeing the family left behind and boy, the questions they must have and the uncertainty and the frustration, you know, that they believe, you know, that she could have been murdered and framed, and not being in, being able to get official sources to take them serious. So Seeking Justice. Now, this is a weekly program on YouTube, and each episode is done live, complete with live interviews, every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And that, like I said earlier, is a very cool way of unveiling your investigation. But it's also got to be tricky. From a procedural perspective, you know, how's that going?
It's been a bit of a challenge, but we knew that when we started. Dawn's case hasn't gotten much local coverage. Many journalists feel that it is just too big to cover. It is a complicated case. I mean, there's no doubt. This is why we have chosen to invite experts in to share their thoughts on the case. And of course, that creates its own challenges, because sometimes there are tech issues where we lose a guest for 10 minutes and we need to kind of fill the space. But it has worked out really well. We have been able to manage those. It's been very well received by our viewers and listeners. But I think the most challenging piece has been remaining unbiased. So it's difficult to not form a bias when we are amassing all of this evidence. So I think that's been, for me, one of the most challenging parts. We do not want, we let our experts speak. We remain as silent as we can. So the opinions are coming from people who really know. We're, like you said, doing the interview.
That one thing that's really interesting with John's case too is that there's so much documentation. There's transcripts and emails and all sorts of things. So for those of us who do cold case research, that's not always common. We're pretty spoiled in that regard in this case, to have as much documentation of things that we do, because we can literally kind of use the documents to tell the story itself.
And for people who really want to go down that rabbit hole, you said freetonyviola.com. Are those documents there? I mean, does he collect all that
stuff? Yeah, so there's two places you can find it. So justicefordawn.com and freetonyviola.com. And there's evidence lockers at both of those respective websites, and you can quite literally fall down the rabbit hole for hours.
Now, you've done 5 weeks. How many more weeks of live programming can we expect ahead?
We don't have a specific number of episodes planned because this is an active investigation in our eyes. In the fall of last year, Yale Law School argued for the release of case evidence and Dawn's wire recordings. So we're still waiting on the judge's ruling, which should come any day now, but it could not. It could take longer. We also have experts reviewing aspects of Dawn's case, and their reviews are still pending. Because the investigation is ongoing, we are committed to producing as many episodes as we need to tell Dawn's story.
Well, I just want to remind our listeners, you don't have to catch the episodes live if that particular time, Wednesday at 7, is inconvenient. They are preserved for you to watch at your convenience. Just search Seeking Justice, Dawn Pasella, P-A-S-E-L-A, on YouTube, or find the link. We'll put it in our episode notes. Ladies, any response from the Parma police at this point? You know, any indication that officials are paying attention and might want to revisit this?
Well, I will say first that we've had more of a interesting reception from the public and the audience, which is nice. Tony, being local to Ohio, he's been doing a lot of great boots on the ground work, getting flyers and postcards out there. So people are starting to learn Dawn's name and get the story out there, which is fantastic, especially because, as Dana mentioned before, getting coverage on the case is very hard. I think it's fair to say that our show is really one of the only real coverages of her case, especially as a deep dive, that's accessible, because they've tried very hard to kind of prevent the story from getting out there. But I think what's interesting too for people to understand, that, like, to be drawn into the case, is that there's so many different aspects of it that draws you in. Whether you're interested in the misuse of power, the wrongful conviction, the infidelity with Dan Caceres, the mortgage fraud, or even the death of this whistleblower, there's something that will, I think, really resonate for everyone, which is an interesting thing to this case as well. But I think people have been really receptive to the show, and I think they also see how much care we've given the family in this, because they're such an important part of us being able to tell this story.
I mean, what would it take to get this case reopened and seriously investigated? Is there any hope that that can actually happen?
Absolutely. I mean, there's definitely always hope. You know, like we had mentioned, there are a couple things going on behind the scenes for Dawn's case. And even with that, there's a lot that still hasn't been done. I think one thing that we're going to go into this in a future episode, but last year in 2023, the Cuyahoga County Sheriff's Department did a review of Parma's job with her death investigation. And the Sheriff's Department identified serious concerns that they had with how everything was initially done. And they identified new avenues that Parma should be going down, of people to investigate, certain pieces of evidence to collect. We didn't talk about cell phones and laptops here today, but again, for your listeners, if they want to fall down the rabbit hole, there's technology evidence in this case that has yet to be uncovered. And so the Sheriff's Department really put the ball back in Parma's court and said, you know, there is work to be done. There is evidence that needs to be reviewed. And Parma has yet to follow through with that. So we're very hopeful that this will be reopened, and we're just going to keep pushing the envelope.
Are you getting any tips? And is there a place people can go if they want to come forward with information?
Yes, the Justice for Dawn Facebook page has attracted people from all over the country. Cleveland locals have been leaving comments and sharing bits of information. Most everyone who hears about Dawn's story realizes that just something isn't right. We believe somebody knows something, and we are doing everything we can to entice this somebody or somebodies to come forward. We previously announced a reward, and last night we shared our anonymous Seeking Justice tip line.
You know, I'll never forget a detective telling me once, somebody knows what happened. Probably way more than one person knows what happens. It is not a mystery to them. We just need to find out who they are or who knows them and get that answer to the proper authorities. So good luck, ladies. I hope it happens.
We are offering a $10,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of the person or persons responsible for the murder of Dawn Pacella. And our brand new tip line, you can either call or text. It's at 580-8-SJ-TIPS, which is 580-875-8477.
All right, let's repeat that. 580-875-8400. If you have anything that might be of help, don't be shy. Just call and share it. Let the pros decide whether it's helpful. Don't hold it in. And maybe we can get some justice for Dawn. Well, ladies, thank you so much for being an advocate for Dawn and sharing her story with us. Folks, we have only scratched the surface of this story. There is so much more to learn by watching Seeking Justice. The next episode will go live Wednesday at 7 p.m. And I can't wait to see what else you guys... Remember, this is still an active case. I mean, there are still decisions to come and things that are happening. So for the near future, this is something that's going to be ongoing. So ladies, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's it for tonight, listeners. For photos, news clippings, and more on this and every episode, hop on over to OhioMysteries.com. And we will see you here next week for another episode of Ohio Mysteries.
A news story gets shared by a friend on social media, or you catch a tweet that really makes your blood boil. But how do you separate fact from fiction? That's the premise behind Disinformation, a 10-part series from Evergreen Podcasts and Emergent Risk International coming this fall. Tune in to Disinformation wherever you get your podcasts, and remember, don't believe everything you read.